You're listening to the Canoe World Order, episode 354. My name's Fatu. In this episode, we're going to talk about DM API, DMI, Decode, a couple of the other tools in that package, and DVD RW tools, which will close us out of the D section of the AP software series of Slackware. Before we do that, though, I'm going to take some listener email. And this one is from Robert, and Robert says that there is a matter of trust when talking about open source software. Many times when I'm referred to a software to try by a friend, I am eager to try it because I trust the person. If there's someone who normally recommends open source software, I start to believe that any software they recommend is open source. And so it's a little disappointing when someone I consider an open source recommender occasionally recommends something that is not open source. This is a great point. Thanks for the email. If you become known, whether you mean to or not, I guess, if you become known as the open source solution person, you're the person to go to for that open source recommendations, and then one day you out of the blue secretly recommend a closed solution, a closed source software, then that's a little bit of a betrayal of trust. I mean, again, it kind of depends, I guess, on whether you were consciously being that resource or not. And if you think about it, I mean, in real life, in the great wide world out there, if you just approach a random person, a lot of times when they suggest software, there is an unofficial kind of just sort of a courtesy caveat there at the end about the price of the software, about the sort of what you're signing up for. So if you hear someone recommend, for instance, GIMP, because that's one that actually does get recommended fairly often out there, I think, but at least in the circles, in the non-open source and non-computing circles that I run in, GIMP is a pretty frequent thing that gets mentioned. GIMP and Blender both, actually. So anyway, you might hear people say, oh yeah, you can make these graphics with GIMP. You should download it. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. That sort of thing. They may or may not say that the key phrase open source, right? Because a lot of people out there don't know what that means. They don't care about that. But if they hear, oh, you don't have to pay for it, you can just download it and use it, people understand that concept. And so if you're the person sort of in the bizarro world version of that great world out there that we go out into every day, if you're the person who flips everything up on its upside down and defaults to open source, you are known now. Your default setting is, hey, it's free, you don't have to pay for it, you can just download it and start using it, which translates in your and my minds to open source. Then I think you do kind of owe it to someone. If you suddenly out of the blue violate that default setting and recommend something that's non-open, then you would want to put that caveat at the end where you're saying, oh, and it's not free to use. You do have to pay for it. You can't just go and download it. You have to pay for it, download it, and you don't own the software. You're paying for a license to use the software. That's an important thing to mention if everything else you've ever mentioned has been open source. So there is this, as Robert in his email says, there is this sort of mention or this expectation or matter of trust. And it's important, I think, I mean, whether you're building a personal brand as like the open source representative in your community, whatever that community might be, or whether you're just kind of doing what you normally do, it's important to understand that if you frequently recommend open source, then if you're violating that, if you're going against that trend, then make it explicit, make it very clear that this solution isn't open source. I mean, especially if it's a thing that is $0 to use, that confuses the matter, the issue even more, because now you normally recommend the stuff that's $0 and open source, and now you're recommending something that's $0 but not open source. Make that clear so that you're not sort of betraying anyone's trust, whether that trust is implicit or explicit or voluntary or involuntary. It's something to be aware of. It's something that I've become more aware of in my own life in the past couple of years. I've gone to places for sure that I thought, okay, this is going to be this is going to recommend open source solutions for this task. And then maybe I'll find something that has closed source components that aren't quite advertised very well. And so you adopt something and you think, okay, well, this is it. This is what I'll use. It's open source. I found it on this thing. And then later you realize that it wasn't entirely open source. That can be annoying. And I strive not to do that in my own recommendations. Okay, so that's everything that I can think to say about that, but it's a great point. Thanks a lot for the email. And let's look at some Slackware packages now. So the first thing that I want to talk about is DM API. DM API is out of the AP package set in Slackware. That's where we are. If you recall in the previous, not the previous episode, but the previous episode where we were talking about these tools, we were looking at diffstat and diffutils and dvrescue and so on. So we're still in AP. We're in the D section, and we're going to try to clear out the D section this time around. I think we can do it. And the first one is DM API. DM API, by its own description in the Slackware description file, says that it is a library required to use the data management API. That's DM API or DMAPI. This interface is defined in the X Open Document Systems Management Data Storage Management XDSM API dated February 1997. It states here that the DMAPI or the DM API library is used by the XFS dump utility. And the package contents is pretty sparse. It has user include xfsdmapi.h, so a header file, a libdm.a, so that's a library archive file, and then a man page, which doesn't really say a whole lot. I did look at it at one point. Yeah, it's like five lines, and it simply points you to this white paper at opengroup.org/onlinepub/9657099/talk. That's toc.htm. It's a really good paper. That's good. That's my summary of this package. You should go read this paper. It's really, really good. It talks about DM API and what it brings to the system beyond what is defined by POSIX. And it would be unreasonable, I feel, to try to summarize the whole thing, because it kind of goes all over the place. But it does have a lot of interesting points about what is contained in DM API. And it's not super clear from the paper. I mean, it sometimes is. Sometimes it calls it out very specifically. It's not always clear what DM API is bringing to your system because POSIX lacks the thing, or what it's bringing to your system in addition to what POSIX has, if that makes any sense. So it's a little bit unclear sometimes as to like how cool this is, or if it's just sometimes an alternate kind of optimized way to do something that happens to be possible in POSIX as is. But it's a pretty important little library for data management. Obviously, it's called Data Management API. But it does a lot with file attributes, like metadata, or really file attributes, I should say. But you can think of that, I guess, as metadata. I think that counts as a type of metadata. Some stuff with permissions, and certainly quite a bit of stuff with how files are defined on disk with regards to sort of sparse files. So if you think about the way that your computer system saves data to a hard drive, you and I, we kind of think of it in very simplistic terms, possibly, and you just think, okay, well, we've got a drive here, we've got this pool of data, and when I arbitrarily, suddenly, randomly create a file, that file is placed on the disk, and it's just that simple, right? I mean, it's an icon, you can see it in your file manager, so that must be the file. There it is, I can see it right there. It's a .mp4 file. That's not a big deal. Well, of course, it is a big deal to your computer, because you, especially to the hard drive specifically, to the thing that is managing that data, because it doesn't know what your plans are for that file. It doesn't know if that's going to be a big file or a small file. Is this a file that's going to last for years and years to come, or is it just a temporary file that you're going to ditch in a couple of minutes, or that's going to disappear at the end of your login session? It has no way of knowing any of this, of your plans for this file. So it has to figure out how it's going to make room on your, within your pool of available space. It needs to make room for this file that it had no idea it was going to have to make, and it has no idea what the future of that entity is. That's a bizarrely tall order for sort of system management, or more specifically, I guess, data management. But the DM API helps keep this flexible because it has, I mean, POSIX does have some allowance for empty space in a file. And there is explicitly a directive in the POSIX specification that says if there is blanks, you know, if there are gaps, there are holes in a file, then it should return zero for that. I guess as opposed to simply crashing or not knowing how to deal with intentionally empty space. But DM API has a little bit more by way of managing that, of handling these gaps or these holes in files. And those are important because eventually those are going to have to get expanded with data. Or if you're backing up a file, what do you do with that empty space? How do you represent that when you're backing up the file? So that's one of the many things that DM API is able to put some definition around. There's also the concept of ownership and access permission. DM API has a bunch of stuff that deals with that as well. And then, as I say, file attributes. There are extended file attributes that DM API can handle. Data written to a disk doesn't necessarily have extended attributes, not really. If you, for instance, DB some text onto a hard drive or into a space on a hard drive, then there are no attributes of that file. It is just pure data on a drive. But DM API allows you to have further attributes, further information about the files that you save, and that could be anything from, you know, file creation time, to modification time, to fancier stuff like what label is this file going to get? Can I tag this file with some kind of information to make it easier for some tool that I'm developing to find the file later, and so on. So that's what DM API does. It is an interesting little library and a more interesting, I think, paper. I will definitely link to this in the show notes, because if you're interested in the way that files are handled and stored and how all of this stuff kind of comes together, this is a must read. Okay, next up is DMI Decode. This looks like DMID Decode or something like that, but it's actually DMI Decode. DMI stands for Desktop Management Interface, which, if you don't know what that is, you may recognize something called the SM BIOS, which is the System Management BIOS, which is, you know, BIOS. And I think generally we all kind of know what BIOS is. I mean, even back when I was still a user of a computer that famously did not have BIOS. I mean, it had obviously firmware, but it wasn't, they didn't call it BIOS, they called it firmware. Even then, I kind of knew what BIOS was. I just didn't know exactly what to do in it or how to really, what it was for and how to get there and so on. I figured it out though, thanks to Linux. Anyway, BIOS, or the desktop management interface, it's on the board of the computer that you are using. It's the hardwired, like literally hardwired, information on the computer that basically has to be there in order for the computer to do anything after you power it on, right? I mean, if you can collect a bunch of computer parts and string them together, like a hard drive and some I don't know, a DVD drive or something, and maybe some USB ports, maybe like a USB card, a PCI card with USB ports on it, you could string all those together, I guess, and apply power to them, and none of them separately are going to do anything at all. They need the firmware to kind of control all that stuff, and certainly you'd want that CPU. But even, again, I mean, if you had a CPU thrown in there, you could string all that stuff together, and it just wouldn't know what to do if you powered it on. And the reason that your computer sort of comes to life and knows to look for a bootloader and then to look for a bootable kernel that's all a function of the firmware, of the BIOS, or rather of the firmware, and BIOS is the way that you sort of access that firmware, more or less. So BMI decode is a way to, on your computer that is running, on your Linux computer that is currently running, BMI decode allows you to see the information contained in your SM BIOS and to query it as well. So the easiest command of BMI decode, in Slackware it is in user sbin. So that might be by default not on your path. I mean, it isn't by default on your path, so unless you've added it yourself, it won't be there. Meaning that you can type in BMI decode and hit return or enter, and it'll tell you that command cannot be found. But if you give it the full path, user sbin, your slash user slash sbin slash BMI decode, then it tells you that it can't access slash sys slash firmware slash BMI slash tables slash smbios underscore entry underscore point scanning slash dev slash mem for entry point slash dev slash mem permission denied. So this is kind of a cool error message because it kind of tells you what it is trying to look at, which itself is sort of nice to know, because without knowing that, it is a little bit of a magical command. It's just something that you could type in and get a bunch of information from and not really understand where that information is being kept. But if you do the slash user slash sbin slash dmi decode preceded by sudo or sudo, and then type in your administrative password, or if you don't have sudo set up, you can do su space dash c space, I guess just slash user slash sbin slash e dmi decode, then you can type in your root password and still get the information. Whichever avenue you go, I recommend using pipe less because it is a lot of information. And here it is. It gives you dmi decode 3.0 getting smbios data from sysfs. smbios 2.7 is present. 60 structures occupying 2,445 bytes. Table at 0xbc41b018. Handle 0x0000, DMI type 0, 24 bytes, BIOS information, vendor, American Mega Trends Incorporated, runtime size 64 kilobytes, and so on. So this is a bunch of information about, the BIOS, the motherboard, and the firmware contained on it. That's in my computer right now, so you're seeing a report, if you're using this, on what is kind of running underneath your OS. And there's some useful stuff here, too. I mean, I'm sure it's all very useful, but I mean certainly if you wanted to, for instance, check to see how recent your firmware is, that this might be a good avenue to find that out. But you also get like some of the settings that are flipped on or off. So PCI is supported. BIOS is upgradable. BIOS shadowing is allowed. Boot from CD is supported. Selectable boot is supported. BIOS ROM is socketed. EDD is supported. 5.251.2 megabyte floppy services are supported. I didn't know that, for instance. And so on. So it just kind of, it runs down the list of all the different features that your motherboard has available to it. And it keeps going. There's a bunch of different places here. A bunch of this was supposed to be filled in apparently by the manufacturer, and they haven't been, so I don't know really what that means. It tells you information about the CPU that is currently socketed into it. Socket designation, socket 942, type central processor, family effects, manufacturer AMD, and so on. So it gives you a lot of the different things that you would find when you're doing CPU info. For instance, it does identify that FPU is a feature. VME is a feature. That's kind of important. Let's see, MSR, I don't know what that is. APIC, that's there. MMX technology, SSE, SSE2 is there, and so on. HTT. So yeah, there's a bunch of features sort of listed there. It tells you how many cores you have and so on. And you can kind of just, I mean, it's a lot of information. You type it through less and you get just all kinds of information about a lot of different things attached to your motherboard. So check that out. It's DMI decode. Now, according to the DMI decode man page, you can also query things kind of specifically. Well, first of all, I should also mention that you can redirect the memory location. So default is slash dev slash mem, but with the dash dash devs dash mem, you can point it somewhere else. I don't know why you need to do that, but you can do it. You can also just query a specific keyword with dash dash string and then keyword. So for instance, if I wanted to do sudo dmi, no, I have to do it with the full path, and then dash dash string and processor dash family. Let's do that. It's asking me for my password again because it's been too long since previously, and it returns fx, which is correct. I could do string processor dash manufacturer, and it returns AMD, which again is correct. So there are a couple of different keywords that you can use. Well, there's not a couple. There's a slew of keywords that you can use, and you can find those in the main page. There is also a dash dash type option, so that you can tell DMIDecode to display the entries of a specific type. So for instance, BIOS, system, baseboard, chassis, processor, memory, cache, connector, slot. So you can kind of narrow down some of the information. There are a couple of different options there, but I'm not going to go through them because I wouldn't be able to really demonstrate how they're used. But you can check them out. They're there. A lot of it is for, I think, debugging and testing and so on. Not stuff that I need. But yes, if you're doing that sort of thing, if you're hacking on either firmware itself or something that needs to know what firmware is available or what features are available, DMIDecode is a pretty good place to start looking, I would think. Okay, next up is BIOS Decode. That's in the same package. It's part of the DMIDecode package in Slackware. And it's similar. It parses BIOS memory and prints out information. So if we do sudo slash sbin slash BIOS decode just as is, we get some output. It's only about a screenful. It's not quite as much as DMI decode. It's, for instance, ACPI 2.0 is present. OEM identifier is Alaska. I don't know what that means. SMBIOS 2.7 is present. Structure table length, 2445 bytes. We've seen that before. Structure table address, we've seen this before. A couple of thoughts on this. First of all, the man page explicitly lists as a bug, and I'll quote here, "Most of the time BIOS decode prints too much information. You don't really care about addresses. Or not enough, because it doesn't follow pointers and has no lookup tables." So that says to me that ultimately this is a tool for verification. It's not something, I don't think you would probe this to actually glean information to then base your work on. I think it's something that you would check if something is not working the way that you would expect it to work. That's kind of the sense that I get about this tool. Now, I don't know because I've never used this thing before, and I've certainly never used it in a practical sense. But it does tell you, for instance, whether it checks whether ACPI is present. That would be important, probably. You would need that if you're writing something that's going to use ACPI, then that would definitely be something you'd want to know about the system. Maybe you want to know if it's being detected correctly, because maybe on the box that said that the motherboard did support it, then you're not so sure now that that's being picked up. PMP, is that supported or not? And if so, where is that getting registered? Although, as the man page says, you don't care about where it's being registered, actually. So, and you can look at the source code for BIOS Decode, of course. I mean, it's open source. Pretty straightforward. I mean, insofar as I have no idea what it's actually doing, but I mean, it is, it's, if you read it, it's written in C, and it's very clear as to what its function is. It definitely has it. Well, it's got very, very nicely clear function names, first of all. And even if you look at the arguments and so on, you get the sense that you understand exactly what's going on here. It's pretty straightforward. It's very simple to understand, I should say. The output versus the source code that you're looking at, they match up. You look at it and you just think, oh yeah, I can see how that would have produced that output, and I can see that there's not a whole lot of options here, because this is all it's doing. It's just looking at the memory location, doing some formatting of what it detects, and dumping it out into the screen. So it's a kind of a nice little application to look at, actually, because it's pretty straightforward. At least to look at. Again, I'm not actually saying that it's easy to have written. I have no idea how that sort of thing, how people figure that stuff out. It's amazing. So anyway, Ownership is the next tool in this bundle, and I've never used it and cannot use it, really. It's called, or rather, it's Ownership, and the man page says that it's Ownership. Compaq Ownership, that's Compaq, the brand of computer, C-O-M-P-A-Q. Ownership Tag Retriever. Ownership retrieves and prints the ownership tag that can be set on Compaq computers. Contrary to all other programs of the DMI decode package, Ownership doesn't print any version information or labels, but only the raw ownership tag. This should help its integration into scripts. Well, I don't have a Compaq. I don't believe I've ever had access to a Compaq at all. So I can run Ownership, but it doesn't return anything, and I don't know how I would be able to emulate that. I probably maybe could emulate it, because you can set, according to the man page, where it's looking for this information, and that is, again, the --dev-mem file, and by default it looks to --dev/mem, but I wouldn't know what information to put into a spoofed --dev/mem, so I cannot do that, cannot emulate the functionality of Ownership. Okay, and then finally, there is VPD decode. VPD stands for Vital Product Data, and it is information that can be found in almost all IBM and Lenovo computers. Available items are BIOS build ID, box serial number, motherboard serial number, the machine type and model, and then sometimes the BIOS release date and the default flash image file name. I happen to have a Lenovo and was able to run this, and the output was remarkably similar to the other tools we've already covered. It simply talks about, I guess, some attributes that, or some metadata about the system that would not be present on other systems. So for instance, if I do run VPD decode with sudo on this computer that I'm on right now, my Slackware machine, there are no VPD structures found. But if you do it on a Lenovo, like on my work laptop, if I run it, I do get the information advertised. I get the BIOS build. I don't know if I got the box serial number, but I definitely got the machine type and model, which was kind of cool. And you'll see this in other systems too. There are sometimes other systems that will have a specific command to get some kind of magic designation for the thing that it's running on. I think, if I recall correctly, Raspberry Pi has something like that, for instance. And then I know that Apple has, I think it's just machine command, possibly, something like that. And it gives you sort of like some kind of more or less human-friendly designation of that computer, which is useful for Apple products especially, and Raspberry Pi, really, because they tend to just kind of designate the product sort of by year or by revision number or by description. It's really hard sometimes to look back and figure out what it is exactly you have. I literally have a Raspberry Pi right here on my desk that no matter how hard I look online, I cannot identify this thing, because as far as I can tell, none of the pictures on the Raspberry Pi Foundation site match this description. There's but one, well, two USB ports, but I mean it's stacked on top of each other, so it's one block of USB ports, and everything on their site seems to have two blocks. There don't seem to be enough GPIO pins, and the layout isn't the revision A version of the Pi, so I have no idea what version of Pi this is. It does say on the board Raspberry Pi 2011, but it doesn't seem to really match up anything that I see having been released in 2011, so I don't know. I don't know what kind of Pi that is. Don't know how to find out either. I guess I could try installing Raspbian onto it and then doing a doing one of these commands to see if it can sort of self-identify itself. But it is a little bit tricky sometimes to know what you're actually on. Okay, let's have a coffee break, and let's come back and talk about DVD-RW tools. Yeah, let's do that. I don't know how long we can talk about it, but we'll try. We'll give it a good go. At least we'll get a coffee out of it. See you soon. Thank you. Okay, that was a. I know this is a little bit of a late coffee break, and I do apologize for that, but I didn't want to break up one complete package with a coffee. So I do have my coffee now. I have had to purchase a new brand of coffee because the little local supermarket in my town, which has like 400 people in it, so we have a very small little supermarket. They didn't have a whole lot of coffee choice this time around. I don't know if it's people consuming more coffee because of the global pandemic or what, but I had to get a different brand. It's called Jed's Coffee. It's a New Zealand brand, I think. And I mean, I've certainly never come across it until New Zealand, but it's actually really good. And interestingly, I have tried it before and it was really bad. But this time around, what I did was I took it into my own. I took it upon myself to make a blend, which I know I've kind of thrown that around several times before, but this time I actually did it pretty intentionally because I remember thinking that the darker roast of Jed's was too dark, really, for a normal cup of coffee, and the lighter roast just didn't taste like coffee at all. So this time I bought two bags, one light, one dark, and mixed them all together in one big jar, and that's what I'm using. And it came out really nice. It's the perfect mix. So that is Jed's Coffee in New Zealand. If you want to try it, I don't recommend it necessarily, but I am enjoying what I've got. Okay, so let's talk about DVD-RW tools. This is a collection of tools to master DVD plus RW plus R-R and -RW media. And look, I've said this before, I think in the CDR episode, but I'm not a fan of optical media. I've never really, really loved it. I feel like it overpromised and underdelivered, but all it did was make it easy for independent artists to distribute their music for a while back before digital downloads had really become so common that it was the obvious smarter choice. Optical media, I don't think, is going to be something that people look back at with fondness. I understand people looking back with fondness at vinyl. To even a lesser degree, I can kind of see it for tape, for cassette tapes, but CDs and DVDs, they're really just, I feel like they're not really a media so much as they're just a really bad storage solution. Although I guess I'm gonna call them media because it is technically media. So anyway, I'm not that excited about terminal commands that have anything to do with CDs and DVDs. Now, with that being said, I do acknowledge the importance of these commands because certainly someone who has to deal with this type of media on a daily basis would probably really, really come to love these commands. I just never had to deal with them myself, luckily, and don't want to start. So anyway, we'll do a user bin DVD plus RW dash book type, and then we'll just do a dash INQ on /dev/InfuriDVD. It says that it is unable to LG_FAH operation not permitted. So we're going to just add a sudo to that. So sudo slash user bin dvd plus r dash book type space dash INQ space /dev/DVD. Says unit will brand DVD plus R media as DVD dash ROM. Unit will brand DVD plus R DL media as DVD ROM. So there we go. There's our output from the dash INQ. Now I actually don't know what -INQ is. I don't know what that means. I'm assuming it means inquiry or inquire, but I don't know for sure because there's no man page. Okay, so there is a dash H or dash dash help that gives you a list of the options. And those options include dash INQ, and it's also dash media, dash unit plus RW, and so on. So we'll try a couple more of these for fun. And again, sudo seems to be necessary in this case. So I do know that I have some media in this drive. I have a blank disk in this drive. So I will again do sudo user bin DVD plus R dash book type. Dash INQ dash media dev d slash dev slash DVD. And it tells me that the current media book type field is 01H, which is the DVD ROM specification revision 1. The book type is, I mean, I haven't looked at this in ages now, but it's part of the specification, the DVD slash CD, the optical media specification. There was I think it was an orange book. And it specified what kind of media would be used for different kinds of data or something like that, or what kind of media could be read on different devices. I'm not clear on it, and I don't because I don't remember it right now, and I don't want to go back and look because it's just not that important to me. But that's what the book type is referring to, is this sort of specification of the media types. I think it was an orange book. I have a memory of that because I remember when I first encountered it way back when I was first starting to use optical media. I just couldn't help but actually picture an orange book. That's about it, I think, for this command. I mean, you can inquire a couple of different properties, and it will either return to you some information or something saying that it has no ability to fulfill what you've been asking. So, for instance, if you do a dash INQ dash unit plus RW on this particular media, it tells you that book typing is not supported on DVD plus RW. So there you go. But that it will brand a DVD plus R and RW or RDL as DVD dash ROM. So which it returned that as well earlier. And that's fine. So let's do a dash INQ dash DVD plus R dash spec on DVD. And yeah, it's just telling me that it's going to brand it as a DVD dash ROM. Okay, so that was, I think, all we can do really with the book type command. Now the next command I can't really use, I mean, I can't demonstrate for fear of erasing a perfectly good blank DVD. And this is probably my last DVD that I have access to. I think I have still some CDRs stashed in a closet, but I this is my, as far as I know, my last DVD. And I may need it for Slackware 15, so I don't want to waste it. And DVD plus RW-format would indeed format this media. It says on the again, no man pages, but on the website for this tool, it says Virgin DD and DVD plus RW media needs to be initially formatted prior to usage. Now, the command grow ISOFS detects when a drive or when a media has not been formatted yet and initiates a format. So I once again don't know why anyone would use this command specifically sort of on its own. I would feel like it would be possibly easier to just use grow ISOFS. But I guess maybe it depends again on what your use case is. Like maybe you don't need grow ISOFS. And so it wouldn't make sense for you to use that. Okay, so next is the DVD plus RW dash media info, which you simply run against your DVD device. So I'm going to do sudo DVD plus RW dash media info slash dev slash DVD. And it returns quite a lot of information about the disk that I have in the drive, which is kind of nice. It tells me the brand of the drive that I have. It tells me what is mounted inside of it, which is 1BH, comma DVD plus R. Current write speeds are 8x, and it gives me a rundown of what that means, kilobytes per second for each speed that I have access to, the write performance, the read structure, and so on. So it gives me a lot of data about the disk. I don't exactly know what I would do with that data, but it is, I imagine, would be very, very useful data if you're troubleshooting something, or maybe if you're trying to see if well, certainly see the specifications of your drive. I mean, I wouldn't know just looking at this drive what the write speeds that it supported were. I wouldn't know that. So getting it through the software or firmware it does seem rather helpful. Okay, the next command, I'm sorry to say, I really can't test actually, just like the format one. This is DVD-RAM-control, and apparently it is to get or set control properties for a DVD RAM disk. And I don't know, I don't have a DVD-RAM disk, so I can't really demonstrate what this does. I don't believe I've ever had one, but you can check or set features of a DVD-RAM disk with DVD RAM control. Okay, and last but certainly not least is grow ISOFS, which this one actually seems pretty useful to me, because it applies to more than just DVDs, certainly. In fact, I don't even need the DVD drive hooked up for this. It's man page says that it's originally designed as a front-end to make ISOFS to facilitate appending data to ISO 9660 volumes residing on random access media such as DVD plus RW, DVD-RAM, plain files, and hard drive partitions. So right there, you know ISO 9660 is related to UDF, or rather it is UDF. So this could be universally useful to grow ISOFS for more than just physical DVDs. It is something that you can use for any UDF file system, probably. So the make ISOFS command was, I think, covered in the CDR tools episodes that I've already recorded. And if not, we only need to know a little bit about it. So we can do a make ISOFS. I've got a demo directory here, which has, let's see what is in my demo directory. Yeah, a little test C++ program, so that's fine. So we'll do a make ISOFS dash O for output, mydvd.iso. So we're going to create a file called mydvd.iso, and we're going to create it out of this directory that I happen to have in my home folder called demo. And it very quickly creates that for me. And it says that, it's impossibly small, really. So I'll do an ls-l of mydvd.iso. And it tells me that it is 368 kilobytes large. So that gives us an ISO to mess around with. And it's a tiny one, so it's going to be easier to spot if we make it grow by any amount. So the way to do that with grow ISOFS would be grow ISOFS-N, which stands for merge. Now, there's no long option there. You can't do --merge. It's just --N. And we're going to point it to mydvd.iso. So we're merging whatever we're about to do with grow ISOFS into an existing ISO. That's important to realize, because if we were doing it to an actual physical DVD, then we would have pointed it to dev DVD. But in this case, we're doing it to a file, so we're just pointing it to the file. And now we just have to tell it what we want to merge with this file. And we could choose anything, really. Let's see if I have anything substantially larger to merge here. Let's do an ls-lh, or actually du-h on this graphic folder. That's 11 megabytes, full of graphics. So we'll do that. We'll just append graphics onto my DVD ISO with grow ISOFS. It took a little bit longer, gave me a little bit more output. But now if I do an ls-lh on my DVD ISO, it tells me that, yeah, it's 11 megabytes now. So it's quite a lot larger. Now, in order to sort of see this all for myself, I would have to mount -o loop my DVD ISO, and then we'll mount it to /mnt/DVD. And now if I list /mnt/DVD, I see that I've got my a.out and my demo, there it is, test.cpp, but in addition to all that, I've got penguin.png, penguin.svg, kitchens.zip, os.tar. Yeah, I've got a bunch of different things in here that wouldn't have been, that weren't in my demo folder. So I've merged more data into an existing ISO, causing the ISO, the file system within that ISO to grow and encompass more files. That's useful. Obviously, that's a good thing. And that's how you use grow ISOFS. There are more options for grow ISOFS. I'm not going to cover them all. A lot of them are very specific to DVDs. So for instance, you can do -overburn, which deals with the different DVD layers. You can do -dvd-compat to provide maximum media compatibility. And this is another problem, of course, with DVD-R, DVD-plus-R, there was just this mess of different formats and different specifications that would or would not play in different kinds of players. It's a horrible, horrible place, a horrible spot in computer history that we should all try to forget about. And these commands aren't helping us, but at least grow ISOFS is useful for self-contained little file systems that you can then grow or shrink as needed with grow ISOFS. I think that's about it for this episode. I know it wasn't necessarily the most exciting thing, although the BIOS inquiries, I thought, were, that was pretty cool. And GrowISO FS is respectable for sure. So that's it. That's it for this episode. But more importantly, I feel that's it for the D section of the Slackware packages, the Slackware listing in the AP software set. So next up is InScript, Flack, GhostScript, GPhoto, things like that. So we're getting into some exciting territories here. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time. Keep away from the junkyard.